rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to our program, my friends. In the tragedy of the day, these miners who have died in West Virginia, whose families for 3 hours believed they had survived. The larger story is not being told at all, which is 5 consecutive years of the Bush administration cutting back on safety standards for mines around the United States. We will be talking about that, and also what kind of safety aggressive advocacy for safety that the United Mine Workers Union would have provided had this been a unionized mine. Would this corporation have gotten away with all these violations and maintaining these violations had this been a unionized mine? We'll be speaking with a member of the communications director from the United Mine Workers of America at the bottom of the next hour, an hour and a half from now, hour and 30 minutes from now. So we will get into that at some length. At the top of the next hour, we're going to be talking with Jeffrey Feldman, editor-in-chief of Frame Shop. Frame Shop is open, talking about what are the new frames that the Bush administration is using to accomplish their goals, change the subject, change your mind, whatever it may be. Right now, though, starting off, Don Alexander is with us. He's with CSNBooks.com. And, Don just vanished. Gee, I wonder if, I don't know what happened. Don just vanished. Off he went. So maybe he just suddenly figured out he was on a progressive show. So we will get back to that in just a minute. Don is a conservative who is going to speak to us about the horrors of Brokeback Mountain. Here's just moving along, however. There's a fascinating story in Reuters today, Reuters International, that raises a really interesting and perhaps larger question, which we'll get to at the bottom of the hour because we have Don back. Hey, Don, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Tom, thanks for having me on. It's an honor.
Sure. Don, and your website, CNSBooks.com?
That's CSNBooks.com.
CSNBooks.com, okay. Don, who's afraid of a couple of gay cowboys?
Say again.
Well, I read your article, and it seemed like basically a slam on Brokeback Mountain and saying, you know, why are we making these horrible movies? This isn't the kind of thing we should be delivering to America. Is that am I mischaracterizing your take? And you're suggesting that it's a failure.
Well, I try to live my life by the scriptures, and I think probably the best answer to that question is, what are we promoting? You know, my book is written toward as a Christian alternative to Harry Potter. My book is called Darnia's Quest. But anyhow, when you start to think about the movie Brokeback Mountain, what are we promoting again to our kids and to the society as a whole? And, you know, I like to ask people the general question, where are we going as a country? Are we going to be a country that is one nation under God, or are we going to promote liberal values to the society that in the end are going to hurt ourselves and our kids?
But this is a really good question. We're speaking with Don Alexander, an award-winning Christian author and author of Darnia's Quest, an alternative to Harry Potter, who has just written a piece essentially saying, you know, Brokeback Mountain, not good. Don, if we are really concerned about things in our movies that are essentially anti-Christian, that are harmful, that are destructive, that lead to death,
right,
why go after a love story? Why not go after, for example, smoking in the movies that kills 500,000 Americans a year?
Yeah, no. By love story, you mean the love...
Love story between two guys, yeah.
Right, between two guys. Let's look at, you know, if we can, please, to the biblical values, you know, of, you know, as they say, you know, in the beginning, God created heaven and the earth, and created Adam and Eve. And I've heard many preachers say he didn't create Adam and Steve, and it's kind of a joke, but...
Can you cite me any scripture where Jesus condemned homosexuality?
Yeah, absolutely. In the book of Leviticus talks about...
I'm sorry, Leviticus was written long before Jesus was born. I said where Jesus condemned homosexuality.
Oh, where the Lord condemned homosexuality. Well, what did he say? He said when he came to the earth, he said, I did not come to abolish the law, but to fulfill the law. And that kind of gave all the Pharisees, they're like, what? Wait a minute now. We thought the law was done. And, of course, you've got sacrifice of animals and different things, so people...
Right, so he fulfilled the law. So all of that stuff back there in Leviticus, I mean, the 693 specific laws, as I recall. In Leviticus, you can't wear clothing made out of two different fabrics. And there are people who still follow many of those, for example, the Hasidim. But a lot of Christians say, you know, we can set that stuff aside. And I have to say, Don, as a Christian myself and as somebody who has literally read the Bible from Genesis to Revelation, every single word in it four times, I can find no reference by Jesus Christ anywhere in the Bible to homosexuality or the condemnation thereof. I do find that John was the disciple that he loved, and he had a tendency to lay with his head on Jesus's chest, but I'm not suggesting that any of them were gay. I just don't see any condemnation of it. But I do find enormous numbers, multiple numbers of times where Jesus comes right out and says that violence is not a good thing, and yet we have movies that are incredibly violent, and I don't hear you complaining about them.
Oh, well, I'm not for the violence for the kids either. But no, what comes to mind, Tom, for me too, and maybe for many other Christians, is, there are some who believe the whole Bible is the inspired word of God and others who don't. I definitely do. When I look back to the story of Lot and Sodom, and when Lot's family was going to sleep with the brothers, the man there in the city, and was encouraging it, and then that's when Lot left. And
well, let's hang on just a second. You're missing something for those listeners who have not read the book, the story of Lot. Lot, first of all, said to the guys, the strangers who came to his house,
yes,
that he would be glad to make available his daughters to them if they wanted.
Right.
And let's tell the whole story. And then when his wife turned to a pillar of salt, Lot slept with both his daughters and produced children by both of them. I mean, you think this is a biblical story that everybody should be promoted?
Oh, I definitely do.
Incest?
One of the reasons that Sodom was destroyed was because of the homosexuality.
No, this was after Sodom was destroyed. This is Lot, the good guy, after Sodom was destroyed, and his wife turns to a pillar, and Lot goes off and sleeps with his daughters, who he had offered to the strangers. Lot, the righteous guy. I'm confused.
Yeah. No, you're hitting it on the
Are you confused, Don?
No, sir. I tell you right now, we got to think about, again, the whole crux of the Word of God, and where are we going with homosexuality. And if he talks about it in Leviticus as he calls homosexuality an abomination. So if it's an abomination, we can't just throw it out the window and say,
But in Leviticus, it also says that it's an abomination to wear clothing made out of two different kinds of fabric, to eat shellfish, there's a whole, as we said, there's a whole long list. And I don't refer, I don't recall Jesus ever referring to this.
I think you'll find 99.9%, I don't know, that's just been my experience, Tom, of Leviticus is right on. Some of the, like you said, the clothing.
Okay, let's go through Leviticus then. Leviticus 25:44 says that I can possess slaves, both male and female, provided that they're purchased from neighboring nations. Now, should I be allowed to purchase slaves from Mexico but not Canada, or should I be allowed to purchase slaves from both?
Well, what did Jesus say? He said that servants obey your masters. So, and I hear what you're saying. We're in a different time period, but at the same time...
But if it's the Word of God, it's the Word of God. So really, if we're going to follow Leviticus, I should be able to buy my slaves from both Mexico and Canada, because they're neighboring nations, and that's what Leviticus says. In Exodus 21:7, let's stick to Leviticus, actually, because that's where you are. Leviticus 15:19-24. It says that I can't touch a woman when she's having her menstrual period. Again, there are people who still follow this, the Hasidim, for example. But how do I tell? I mean, I've tried asking women, and they get a little upset with me.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, what's wrong
not
with
sure
that?
If I should shake your hand,
Definitely, a lot of these are not, they're not bad ideas, I think.
Okay. Leviticus 1:9 says that it's pleasing to the Lord if we burn a bull on an altar as a sacrifice. Do you do that, Don?
No, I don't do that, Tom, I'll be honest. But I'm just saying, again,
Leviticus 11:10 says that eating shellfish is more of an abomination than homosexuality.
I'm just saying that, none of these things are like crazy. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's some people would say, well, gosh, what are you doing out there burning a bowl? You know, but if, you know, God has given us this whole, thank you, Lord. God has given us the Holy Spirit. And what are we supposed to do with the Holy Spirit? He said that that will keep us until the day of Christ's return.
But doesn't it seem, Don, that the values of love should trump the values of violence and hatred?
Oh, absolutely. What did Jesus say? By this wall, men know that you're my disciples if you have love for one another. But if you think about it, I'm developing a sermon called You Took the Friendship Too Far. And, you know, with homosexuality, I think it comes from...
It goes too far. Don, I'm sorry we're out of time, but we got the point. Don Alexander, award-winning Christian author and author of Darnia's Quest, an alternative to Harry Potter. It's 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Every time we think about same-sex parents, oh my gosh, we exclaim. I mean, to people who want to provide a protective and nurturing family environment, have they no shame? It's so deviant. It's the Lord's holy word, as my second wife said to my third. That a family's based on obligation and fear. We're defenders of marriage, connubial narcs, ever vigilant and patriotic patriarchs. Defenders of marriage.
There you go.
Defend the institution against people.
Look out, my friends. Dude, we got to defend America from people who want to get married. Yes, they're the new enemy. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Let's see. I know from Leviticus 11:6 that touching the skin of a dead pig makes me unclean. Should I wear gloves when I play football? Let's see. Leviticus 19:27 says that if you cut your hair, particularly around your temples, that's expressly forbidden. And in fact, that people who do so should die. How should my friends die who get the haircuts? My uncle has a farm. He violates Leviticus 19:19 by planting two different crops in the same field, as does his wife by wearing garments. He also tends to curse and blaspheme a lot. Shouldn't we just put them to death, as Leviticus says? I don't know. The bottom line here is that the Reich has hijacked morality. They're coming along and they're saying, because it says in Leviticus that homosexuality is an abomination. Jesus never said it. Let's be very clear about this. It says it in Leviticus, along with a whole lot of other things, that therefore, that is the sum total of morality. And I just have to say, I'm sorry, anybody who believes that that's the sum total of morality, in my opinion, particularly who claims that they're a Christian, or, you know, religious or spiritual in any sense, but particularly those who come on and say that they're Christians, has not read the words of Jesus, who comes out and says, I'm sorry, no, morality is somewhat different. It has to do with, you know, are there hungry among us? Are there poor among us? Are there homeless among us? Are there those in prison who are not being visited? Are there sick who are not being healed? It's very, very straightforward. It's very straightforward. And as far as Brokeback Mountain goes, by the way, one of my daughters went to see it a couple nights ago, and she said that they were playing it at five different theaters in this big theater chain, and that there were lines to get into it. Turns out, if you look at the January 3rd totals, this is for the four-day weekend that just ended, the number one movie in average sales per theater at $18,020 per theater, number one movie in the United States, Brokeback Mountain. Now, it opened in a smaller number of theaters, so its box office rank was number 13. But in terms of revenue per theater, $18,020. Number two, King Kong, at only $8,000, with a ranking of number two. Pretty amazing. Pretty amazing. Oh, wait a minute. I'm sorry. This is the Larry Page. He's rating what his favorite movies were. Match Point actually opened at $66,000 per theater. So I'm wrong there. It wasn't the number one, but it's up there. It's doing quite well, shall we say. It is not doing badly. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Donald in Sacramento, California. Hey, Donald, welcome to the program. Thanks for calling.
Tom, I've got a problem. I'm a little confused. So
sure.
Incest is okay, but not homosexuality. So I can't sleep with my brother. If it was my sister, it's okay.
Well, Persona Play.
I'm like, one's okay, one's not okay.
See, that's the thing. I mean, I'm always amazed when somebody, you know, when folks like this who are condemning Christianity start talking about Sodom and Gomorrah, because you go back and read it, and I think it's either in Genesis or Exodus. I think it's in Genesis, isn't it? The story of Sodom and Gomorrah. I'm pretty sure. And Lot was, in my opinion, no paragon of virtue. I'm sorry, you know.
Well, and there's no condemnation. There's not anything, and God said this was bad. I mean,
fact, one of the children that Lot fathered with one of his daughters, fast forward to Luke, I believe, either Matthew or Luke in the Gospels, where it's the genealogy of Jesus, is part of the genealogy of Jesus. I mean, it leads from that to David and from that to Jesus.
Yep.
And so, no, it's not only condemned, it's held up as, part of it.
And
I'm not meaning this as a slam on the Bible. I'm just saying, you know, to pick this one thing out and say, oh, yeah, and therefore we should discriminate against 10% of the population of the United States, I think is tragic, let's say. And there's obviously much stronger words that we could apply to it.
Here's the thing is, I'm not a Christian. I don't mean to offend people that are Christians, but you read the genealogy, and they follow it all the way back to David, but they follow it back through Joseph, who is not the father of Jesus.
Yeah, and you go. And here's what's even more interesting. Judaism is matrilineal. Okay, in order to be Jewish, you're truly Jewish. Your mother has to be Jewish, not your father. And I find it interesting that the lineage is patrilineal in the Bible, and Christians have basically picked up patriarchy as a result of that. And I'm curious. I'm not a biblical scholar. I have read Funk and Pagels and others, you know, but I've never encountered anybody, raising this question of how did that happen, you know?
Well, basically, you have to look when the Bible was constructed.
Yeah.
Particularly the New Testament.
There you go. In the 300s under Constantine, right? Yeah, when they essentially reconstructed the Bible. Good point, Donald. Anyhow, we'll continue a few more conversations about that, and then we're going to get into what are the frames that Bush is using here at the top of the next hour, and then we're going to be talking with some folks from the United Mine Workers Union. 27 minutes past the hour. Truth and common sense in broadcasting. I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
I'm just an old truth teller.
I am.
I'm your candid friend.
Welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. The radio support group of, by, and for, we the people of the United States of America. As Francis Beaumont said back in the 1590s, maybe the early 1600s. Not sure the date of the quote. He died in 1616, so must have been before that. Anyhow, Francis Beaumont, the English dramatist, said, "Corruption is a tree whose branches are of an immeasurable length. They spread everywhere, and the dew that drops from thence hath infected some chairs and stools of authority." Yes. And later on in the program, we will also be getting back into who are the folks that Jack Abramoff was paying off. I'll just give you a very quick sample. Number one, who is probably one of the most long-standing recipients of cash from Jack Abramoff, who in exchange for that cash has been doing official functions, which, by the way, is what the crime is that Jack Abramoff has been charged with, is giving politicians cash, and in exchange for that, they do official functions. Looks like probably the most long-standing one is a governor who back in 1997 wrote a letter on behalf of Abramoff, on behalf of a client for Abramoff, the Marianas Islands. The Marianas Islands, remember, a Pacific territory that we seized during World War II. And because it's a U.S. protectorate, if you manufacture things there, you can put Made in USA on the label. And they didn't want to have minimum wage laws there. They wanted to make it a conservative paradise. And Abramoff went to this governor and said, "Would you please write a letter saying good things about the Marianas Islands?" And this governor did in 1997. Abramoff went on to become a pioneer in Governor Bush's campaign, raising over $100,000. He and his wife both gave the maximum limit to Bush's recount fund, $5,000, maximum limits to his 2000 campaign, helped him as governor of Texas. And so it looks like probably the number one corrupt politician who Jack Abramoff has corrupted is George W. Bush. We're also going to be getting into mine safety in the next hours, as that's another big issue of the day. But the culture wars are continuing, and if we don't take this stuff on now and head it off at the pass, it's going to end up dominating the next election. We've got an election coming up in 11 months, and I guarantee you they're going to trot out God, gays, and guns all over again, and we just can't let it happen. 1-866-440-8466, 440-THOM, our telephone number. And Larry in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Larry, thanks for listening on WTKG. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Happy New Year.
Well, thank you, and the same to you, Larry.
We have absolutely no snow here, but I guess it depends on how you're feeling about winter sports.
Yeah, my brother's a sea captain up on Lake Superior, and he just called in and said, you know, usually they're starting to talk about the lake being frozen in by this time, and it was like 33 degrees and warm. He's concerned he's not going to get his winter off.
Oh, well. Tom, I've got a reference you might write down for the response to, like, the gentleman that you just had about Sodom and why it was destroyed and all this stuff.
Well, it was destroyed because they weren't helping people.
Well, yeah, it's exactly. And if
they weren't compassionate.
Referring to Ezekiel, and it says, the sin of Sodom, their daughters were arrogant, overfed, and unconcerned. They did not help the poor and needy. They were haughty and did detestable things before the Lord. Therefore, I did away with them. And detestable could have been any number of things, including child sacrifice.
Right. Now, the problem is that it says that in Ezekiel, but it doesn't say that back in the story of Sodom and Gomorrah in Genesis, where basically just, as I recall, it's Genesis. Maybe you can correct me. I don't have a Bible in front of me. But where the original story is told, and in the original story, it's basically the folks in Sodom and Gomorrah were simply immoral, and they don't specify the immorality.
Exactly.
So it's easy for these guys to get confused because they're not sitting there with a concordance. But
exactly.
Larry Goodwin, I appreciate it. Great to hear from you.
Yeah, you might just want to get them to answer back to that sometimes, and I'd be actually interested in what they'd have to say.
Well, I'll try to make a mental note of it here, Larry, and if I fail to, be sure and call in.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Pete in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Pete, what's on your mind today?
Hello, Tom. Happy New Year, and thanks for taking the call. We appreciate you on the air here at KPTK up in Seattle.
Oh, I'm pleased to be there.
I know you want to get on to this Abramoff thing, but we'll do
that in the next hour. I want to hear from my listeners on this and take this thing out a little bit. So
well, I
go
think
for
it. It kind of all feeds off the same issue: people wanting sort of concrete and very simple approaches to problems that are really pretty complex and a little more hard to understand than a lot of people would like them to be. I look at these fundies and the religious right, and I really see them completely missing the point and wasting what could be a tremendous force for good. If you look at the Bible, you know, in terms of poetry, metaphor, and symbolism, regardless of one's religious persuasion, I think there's a tremendous wealth of information, knowledge, and guidance in the Bible.
It's an enormous body of literature, and there's also parts of the Bible that are really, at least speaking for myself, that are really and truly inspiring, breathtaking, beautiful, awe-inspiring. I by and large, I find the first time I read the Bible, I found it to be a relatively positive experience. Although I have to tell you, reading through the Book of Joshua curled my hair, shocked me, and had me going to my mentor and saying, what is going on here? And if you've never read the Book of Joshua, when you do, you'll understand what I'm talking about. I don't want to turn this into a discussion of the Bible, but anyhow, your point, Pete.
No, but that's why they had to come up with the New Testament. The Old Testament was too scary. But I think that the point that the fundamentalists miss is basically that they have turned the Bible into an instruction manual for building a barbecue. And they want to go and pick out just what fits their particular case at the moment, and they want to, it says here to put nut B on
screw A,
and that's how they, in my opinion, trash what could be a tremendous source of inspiration for people. But because they do that, I think there's a broader point, and that is that they completely miss the chance of doing good. If they're so interested in a culture of life, why aren't they promoting mine safety? You know, we just had a whole bunch of
people
die very possibly because of safety regulations that were rescinded under an administration that trades on the culture of life, and yet this person is calling you complaining about a movie which, you know, it should be up to the marketplace to decide whether that movie is successful or not. I mean,
there you go, Pete. And in fact, the marketplace is deciding that it's a successful movie and it's doing very well. Pete, thanks a lot for the call. Victoria, we're slammed here with phone calls. I got to move along. Victoria in New Orleans. Hey, Victoria, what's up? Veronica, I'm sorry.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey, Veronica, I'm great. What's up?
You know, I just wanted to talk to you about that take that you have on Christian morality. I believe, I'm not a Christian, and I think that Christianity breeds this kind of contempt for people who are different, people who have different lifestyles and whatever.
Veronica, I have to agree with you if you are talking about people like Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson who call themselves Christianity and try to brand all Christians as being like them and anybody who's not like them as not being Christian. But
I would say that if you define
Christianity as those people who follow the teachings of Jesus, it's not at all.
That's what I want to talk to you about, because you were talking about the teachings of Jesus, and I, too, have read the Bible. And, I mean, Jesus was not all about love and forgiveness. I mean, in Matthew 15, verse 3 through 9, Jesus criticized the Pharisees, calling them hypocrites, because they failed to follow God's commandment to kill children who curse their parents. Now, according to Jesus, killing disobedient children isn't just a right, it's a duty. The Christians of today take what they want out of the Bible and say, well, we're going to follow this, and this sounds good.
Yeah.
That's red letter. That's red letter. You were talking about there's no place in the Bible where Jesus condemned, you know.
Veronica, I'm going to have to go back and look for that one. I'm sorry. I don't recall Jesus ever saying, you know, that parents should be killing their children. I'm sorry. It's just not, you know, I do remember him condemning the Pharisees for being hypocrites, for not following their own laws. Alan in Greencastle, Pennsylvania. Hey, Alan, what's up?
Yes, I've been listening to the speeches of Martin Luther King Jr.
Yes, sir.
Oh, they're great. He, instead of using the Bible literally and hitting people over the head with it, he used a symbolism to help the poor people in the down and out, like going over the river to Jordan land or something like
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he had a lot of respect for people of other religions, and so does Jimmy Carter. So I really like those two Christians.
Yeah.
And also, Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech about the Declaration Against the War on Vietnam is just an excellent speech.
It is.
Everybody should listen to that.
Yeah, framed in a religious context. Very, very well said. Thank you very much, Alan. Steve in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Steve, welcome to the program. We got about a minute.
Hey, Tom, glad to talk to you. I thought you said you read the Bible four times and you didn't mention in the New Testament. How about the writings in Romans where it's...
Jesus didn't write Romans. Paul did. Paul wrote Romans, not Jesus, Steve.
Well,
I said, give me a quote from Jesus. He's the founder of Christianity. Give me a quote from Jesus. He never said anything about homosexuality.
Yeah, I like your show, but I mean, you throw out Acts and all that then in the Bible.
Acts was written by Paul too. Arguably, maybe Luke. You know, nobody's sure, I guess. But
I'm shocked you took this stance on it. But
what stance?
That you think it's right for gays or homosexuality to carry on?
I do. I do, Steve. I think that and part of the reason why is because I'm convinced that the science is out there that people are born gay, and I don't think that we should be discriminating against people because they're born a particular way.
Okay. I've never seen a gay baby, but maybe so.
The evidence, there's some substantial evidence that that's the case, that there's actually, you know, physiological difference, brain difference that leads to behavioral difference, which we call sexual preference, and in my opinion, if somebody's born that way, then I'm not going to be the one to tell them they have to be different. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
You gave them the old, stay the course, I'm your man. Why, he'll flip-flop ya.
He has no strength to lead. Yes, this you feared. While soldiers' jobs and surplus disappeared. Gave from the old devil, yeah, devil speak. Yes, with folks swindled him. No one could hear the truth above the roar.
There you go, indeed, and that's exactly what happened. Welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. And welcome to the vast, radical, middle conspiracy, my friends. Take no imitation. Yes, indeed. Probably the most famous study, the sexual brain, Simon LeVay. Neuroscientist studied the brains of 41 corpses, 6 women, 19 gay men, 16 men presumed to be heterosexual, and found that a part of the brain, INAH3, was similar in size between women and gay men, larger in heterosexual men. And, yeah, the attacks, the study's been attacked. There are other studies. But that's really not even the issue in my mind. But in any case, Chris in Franklin, Tennessee. Hey, Chris, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Hey, Chris, you're live and on the air.
Oh, thank you, Tom. It's fantastic to talk to you. We really enjoy your show down here in Tennessee. We have to listen to you by satellite, but I'm great to have Sirius left. My comment is that the last caller said he didn't know of any gay babies. Well, surely somebody in his family knows someone who was had very different mannerisms as a child. I have a cousin that we knew basically from the time he could walk that he would be gay, and it turns out that he is full-blown homosexual. And, you know, that's cool with me. I mean, you know, because we expected it all of our lives. I mean, it was no big surprise.
Yeah, and, you know, it's what's amazing to me, Chris, is that we're not as accepting of this, frankly, as I think we were long ago. I mean, without getting too personal here, my grandfather came over to this country with his 4 brothers, and one was an alcoholic, one had Down syndrome, one was gay, and, you know, 2 were straight white guys. And that was like, this was a normal family.
Exactly.
And, you know, and I remember my gay uncle and you know, who lived down in Texas, and he was one of the most wonderful people, great uncle, whatever, you know, I mean, my grandfather's brother. And I, you know, he was just a wonderful person, and nobody was trashing him in the family, and I'm just so grateful for that we didn't live in a bigoted family that trashed that. I mean, it was back in the 50s, and it wasn't talked about much, but nobody trashed him.
Exactly. So, I agree, and it's just amazing to me that a lot of the people who are coming out who are saying that they're hardline anti-gay are the ones who actually turn out to be closet homosexual.
Yeah, may well be. Thanks a lot, Chris. I appreciate it. Michelle in Cypress, California. Hey, Michelle, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Well, you know, I just love this conversation. It always makes your mind kind of twirl, but I was thinking about, I think it was the king of Persia that killed his wife because she couldn't produce a male son, and it came down to it was really his problem. Because it was the Y chromosome that he wasn't producing.
And that's not the only king in history to have had that problem.
No, exactly, exactly. But, you know,
go back to Henry VIII if you want.
Yeah. Well, if you think about it, though, genetically, there's such a kind of a spin of the wheel genetically that it just amazes me that people want to assign it as you know, gay is a choice.
Yeah. No, I'm sorry, it's not. It may be for some small number of people, but most of the gay people that I've known in my life, it was not a choice. It's just they knew it their whole lives, and that was the bottom line.
Tom, there's a suggestion out there that we're born kind of asexual, and it's through, you know, our genetic, you know, our maturing, and through our
both nature and nurture. Yeah, I don't buy that, Michelle. I think I really think that it's probably primarily genetic, although I don't know. Steve in Memphis, Tennessee. Hey, Steve, welcome to the program. Thanks, Michelle, for the call, by the way.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
I'm great. What's up, Steve?
Hey, I turned on your show just as you were talking to that Christian author, and you argued a point. I've been arguing that point for years to people, and you're the first one other than myself I've ever heard bring up those points that Jesus never mentioned homosexuality or abortions. and the whole thing about Lot and his daughters and all that, and no one ever thinks about that.
And not only that, you could also argue that Jesus was opposed to
religion.
Yeah,
you know,
Steve, okay. Sorry, you got a dirt. We had to dump a piece of your language in there, but your sentiment is appreciated. Rich in Chicago. Hey, Rich, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. God bless you.
Yeah,
thanks for calling out the American Taliban.
There you go.
But
it's really what it is, isn't it?
Yeah. Quickly here. Thanks for bringing up those points of Leviticus. I bring them up all the time, too. And have you ever looked at this 50th year Jubilee that it talks about in there?
Actually, I think that's a good idea. You know, that was
me too.
That's something we should bring back.
Absolutely, I agree. But let me just say a few things real fast. One is I'm always shocked when you hear Christians talk about the Ten Commandments or whatever. These are all like Jewish laws, but Jesus never said anything about this. He did the Sermon on the Mount and said, blessed are the peacemaker.
Well, he went on and he was picking grain on the Sabbath. You know, I mean, he was violating one of the Ten Commandments. Of the Ten Commandments, only two of them, by the way, are law in the United States. Don't steal, don't kill.
Yeah.
All the rest of them are not laws in the United States. It is okay to diss your parents. It is okay to worship other gods.
Jesus took it so much further and said, even if you didn't kill your brother, if you thought about killing your brother, it was still just a sin.
Yeah.
But I understand how Christians get away with all this kind of stuff that they're talking about in war and everything. It blows me away.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway. Rich, you're not alone in that.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call and for your sentiments. Great to hear from you. It's amazing, the culture wars. And these guys, I'm telling you, they're going to trot this old horse out again, and they're going to whip it as hard as they can. It's already started. I mean, that's the reason that we had the fellow on that we had on just a few minutes ago. What was his name? Don Alexander, author of Darnia's Quest. The reason we had him on is because they're sending out this press release to all the talk shows saying, hey, we got to talk about this stuff. Say, okay, you're going to be doing it on conservative talk radio. I think we ought to have our voice out there, too. Tom Hartman with you, 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio, the No Boring Zone, the Tom Hartman radio program. Our telephone number all across the United States, 1-866-440-8466. Our website, if you'd like to drop into our live chat room and say hi, tomhartman.com. However you spell it, it'll get you there, although it's T-H-O-M Hartman with two N's. But still, I think we have all four possible misspellings. Jeffrey Feldman is with us. Jeffrey Feldman runs frameshopisopen.com. And one of the great voices out there in the wilderness about how the Bush administration is framing, using framing, using one of these core neurolinguistic programming functions to influence public opinion. Hey, Jeffrey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too, Jeffrey. Great to have you back with us. What are the latest frames that the Bush administration has trotted out?
It's interesting. I just listened to the president talk a couple minutes ago. He gave a speech directly following the announcements about those West Virginia miners that had perished in that accident. And he took the opportunity to roll out an old frame that the White House is using to define terrorism in the minds of the public, something that I call a hunt-and-gather frame. It's a very basic idea. Every time Americans talk about terrorism, they do so using two related ideas, that we are hunting down the terrorists and we are gathering intelligence. And therefore, any time a Democrat questions either one of those acts, there is this perception that the world is becoming a more dangerous place. And today, in the president's comments on television, he used this concept of hunting terrorism. He rolls out very complex ideas about about setting up new democracies in Iraq. And then he throws out this very simple frame that we are hunting terrorists as if they are animals hiding in holes and not intelligent and not capable of thinking in sophisticated ways.
Yeah, I mean, it blows my mind how successful, actually, he's been in doing this. Jeffrey Feldman of FrameShopIsOpen.com. For example, Bush pushing the idea that we're going to fight them over there so we don't have to fight them here, which assumes that there is, a limited number of terrorists, and no more will come into existence. And if we can simply isolate them all in one place, we're going to be okay. And B, assumes that they are so stupid they don't know how to get on an airplane and come to the United States.
Yeah, it is quite remarkable, because when you think back to what 9/11 was, these were people who were living in a foreign country for whom English was a second language, who used incredibly sophisticated means to transfer finances across the global system and hide those transactions, who learned how to fly airplanes as normal civilians using virtual technology and using simple things in the world around them, $1.99 box cutters, e-tickets on airplanes, in order to transform passenger aircraft into guided missiles. And then you have our president turn around and treat these people, talk about these people as if these are, as if they're animals. And it's very deceptive, because it fools people into thinking that the enemy we face is not one that's sophisticated, but one that's just brutal, lurking in a hole that we need to smoke out in order to prevent ourselves from being attacked again.
Do you think it's possible that in Bush's world, that is that his world really and truly is that simplistic, or do you think that this is really a very sophisticated intelligence operation, a psychological manipulation operation?
I think that the hunting, in particular the use of this concept of hunting, is deliberate. I don't think that Bush is by nature someone who uses these metaphors, but that they use this in order to garner support amongst the public for whatever it is that they wanted to do vis-a-vis transgressing the limits set up by the Constitution for executive power. I've noticed this in particular, that it's surprising that there hasn't been more of a public outcry against the president's trampling the Constitution in order to listen in on phone calls. There was a whole process set up, and rather than using this process of these special courts in order to get special permission to hunt down or to pursue the terrorists, I just did it. I slipped into it. He circumvented it. I think the reason that people are more outraged is because of this particular metaphor, and that leads me to think that it's very intentional. The more times they repeat that concept of hunting and gathering, the less people are inclined to question even the most problematic uses of executive power.
You know, what's so ironic about it, Jeffrey Feldman, is that with FrameShopIsOpen.com, is that the hunting-gathering people of the world are being systematically exterminated by the agriculturalists and industrialists of the world, which is us. I mean, it's such an irony.
It is ironic. It definitely is ironic.
Yeah, that hunting and gathering would be the new frames that they would be holding up. What do you see coming down the road? How do you the NSA wiretapping? For example, I noticed that there was recently a poll done where they said, "Do you believe that George W. Bush was wrong to wiretap terrorists calling into the United States?" And they never in the poll said illegally wiretap, and they never in the poll pointed out he was doing it without a warrant. Still, I was surprised. 62% of Americans said they thought it was fine, which means, frankly, I would think 100% of Americans would say, yes, of course he should be able to listen in on conversations of terrorists, but with a warrant. And, what does this tell us about where America is at and how these frames are working for the Bush administration?
I think we're in a very problematic place. I think that so long as the American public believes that we need to be gathering intelligence in order to launch these killing expeditions on terrorists, they will concede to every claim by Cheney, for example, that the presidency needs to be more and more powerful. People won't see these particular transgressions as affecting their individual lives. Instead, they will see them as the last barrier against inevitable attacks by these animals that are living amongst us that we need to go out and get. So I think it's a real big problem. Unless the Democrats redefine the terrorist threat in different terms, in more sophisticated terms, then the American public will not have an alternative. I'll tell you, that's a very difficult problem to solve because it's not very easy to come up with a frame that works as easily as the simplistic hunting and gathering frame.
Well, and you just used the phrase, excuse me just a second. pardon me, had to cough there. You just used the phrase, the animals living among us. And I lived in Germany for a year in the mid-'80s, and a little over a year. And I remember speaking with somebody who was at that time in her 80s, and who lived through the Nazi era, and said, you know, did you know what was going on? And, of course, you know, the big myth in America is that Germans didn't know. And she said, yeah, pretty much everybody knew something was going on. You know, the Jews were being gathered up. They were being taken out. She said, you know, I didn't know that they were necessarily being run through camps where they were being systematically murdered, but we knew that they were being put in labor camps, forced labor camps, because there were hundreds of these forced labor camps inside Germany. The death camps were all actually built outside Germany, so Hitler could have plausible deniability. But in any case, but she said, the point that she made was, she said, you have to understand, I'm sure I'm paraphrasing badly from memory from, you know, many years ago, but anyhow, she said, you have to understand, for several years, they had done their propaganda so well that they had succeeded in convincing us, and she's referring, by us, she's referring to white Christian Germans. She said they had succeeded in convincing us that the Jews and the other enemies of the state were somehow less than fully human. That they were a them, not a dysfunctional part of us, but a separate them. And therefore, whatever it takes to deal with them is acceptable. And you just use the phrase, you know, these animals among us. And this is a theme that I've been noticing in the Bush, in the frames that Bush has been using, virtually from day one, certainly from the beginning of 9/11. And again, I'm wondering if you think, Jeffrey Feldman, does this worldview come out of George W. Bush's own mind, or is this, are we looking at another Goebbels operation here?
I think that it comes from the team that's generating his communications, that they are systematically redefining anybody who lives in the Muslim world who is Arabic as something less than people who live in other parts of the world.
I mean, they're doing the same thing with gays right now.
Exactly. As long as people don't relate to those people as fully human, then the administration will have freedom to manipulate public opinion.
That's right. I mean, you know, how dare they want to get married, you know, or teach in schools, or, you know, et cetera. I mean, fill in the blank, right? Or liberals. I mean, I'm hearing right-wing talk show hosts talk about liberals, and I'm listening, and I'm going, this guy's not describing me. I don't understand what, you know, what's liberals just hate America. They're trying to destroy America. I'm going, what? And it's a creating of a them.
Objectifying the enemy.
Objectifying the enemy. That's the phrase. So in just a few seconds here, Jeffrey Feldman, what do you see coming?
The Alito nomination. We're going to see the return of the up or down vote phrase that the administration loves to use, and Democrats should not get drawn into that. The reaction to the response to that is to call Samuel Alito a man who works for the president rather than an independent judge.
Interesting. Good. Jeffrey Feldman, frameshopisopen.com. The website. Be sure to put the is open part on the end. Frameshopisopen.com. Jeffrey Feldman, thanks so much for being with us, Jeffrey.
Thanks, Tom.
Always great speaking with you. 16 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's just time to pay the price. Not listening to advice. Deciding in your view on the policy of truth.
And welcome back to the vast radical middle conspiracy, my friends. Take no imitations. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Mike in Eureka, California. Hey, Mike, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom, and it's nice to talk to you again. I'm kind of out of it today, but I had CNN muted while listening to you and saw an ad, and I've been watching a lot of CNN lately because I'm in bed, but it was an ad for the confirmation of Alito.
Sure.
I have not seen that before. Have you?
Well, yeah, there were, as I recall, seven states where during the month of December they were running ads about how Alito had been the judge who brought Christmas back, who ruled against a community that tried to kick a creche, a nativity scene out of their community square, or remove it or whatever. And Alito was the guy who saved Christmas. And those,
well, I probably heard that on your show.
Yeah, those ads were run strategically.
This was,
but yeah.
I didn't hear that.
It's the Swift Boat guys. They're back. And,
so that's who's doing it. That's what I was wondering.
Yeah.
So you know, but when have we ever put advertisements on for the confirmation of a judge? That doesn't go out to the public.
I absolutely agree with you, Mike. And this is a coalition of people who are hopeful that Alito will make abortion illegal. It's the anti-abortion folks. It's the folks who want to see church and state conflated. And it's the corporatists. You've got a whole bunch of corporations who think that Alito is going to do really, really good for them, just like John Roberts will. And that's a really scary thing to me. Greg Gorman with the Talk Radio News Service with us. Hey, Greg.
Well, hello, Tom, and Happy New Year to you and all your listeners.
Well, thank you, and the same to you, Greg.
Well, let's talk about Sam Alito, actually, because, you know, as we know, on Monday, we're going to have the confirmation hearing starting, and this morning, the American Bar Association gave the Supreme Court nominee its highest rating. Now, you know, there are some Democrats who had previously looked at that and said, look, if the ABA says he's good enough for us, he's good enough for us. Now there are people around town who are now suspecting, you know, them to turn on a dime if they have to, and not really look at that, you know, as any kind of gold standard, because they want to go after him, you know, on things like abortion next week.
Well, and besides that, the ABA gives judges ratings not based on whether or not they'd make good Supreme Court judges, the justices. The ABA doesn't take a position on that. They give them ratings based on their competence as an attorney or as a judge in the past.
Right, that's exactly right. You know, will this person be able to do the job on the court? Not, you know, what will they rule?
Well, it's not even that. Have they done a good job? I may be wrong, but I don't think that the ABA rating is prospective. I think it's backward looking rather than forward looking.
Well, and you know what? And that's exactly what the Democrats, you know, will say, in that if he's done a good job in the past, it's by no means an indication of how he will do in the future, especially on very controversial issues like abortion, you know, and like other things, you know, which we'll have to rule on in the next, you know, 20, 25 years, as long as he's on the court.
Yeah, I think the much bigger issues are going to have to do with corporate power and going to have to do with presidential power, frankly, because we have a democracy that's under assault here, Greg.
Well, and, there are Republicans who are now trying to position him as being, you know, very smart and very intelligent and very up on these issues. It's not going to work in the way that it worked on John Roberts, in that he breathes through on his charm and on his intelligence. And Sam Alito, he doesn't have that same gravitas, that John Roberts has. So, you know, look for a lot of the Democrats to really go after him on the issues like you just mentioned, knowing that he might not be able to talk his way out of it the way that John Roberts did.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how this whole thing plays out. Now, I understand Congress had to come back for one day this week, and then they're you know, to basically say, hi, we're here, see you later, and then they're going to come back next week, or am I missing something?
No, that's right. The Senate actually comes back next week, and the House actually comes back the following week. And, of course, it's all a run-up to the State of the Union, which is on January 31st. So, of course, you know, that's when they have to be back in their seats in order to hear from the president.
Now, last year, George W. Bush changed the date of the State of the Union to blow away, as I recall, it was the Iowa primary, was it? The Iowa caucuses?
That's right. This year, it's on January 31st. I think the state has been decided on for a while, so I don't think there's any change now to this.
Yeah.
This is really about, he's obviously going to try to set the agenda, and now that we have the Abramoff plea, most Republicans are starting off the year, looking down the barrel of a gun, if you will, and that they now have to try to distance themselves, especially, if you're Bob Ney.
One of the politicians who in 1997 was writing letters about the Marianas Islands on behalf of Jack Abramoff, and who received hundreds of thousands of dollars from Abramoff, is George W. Bush. I mean, he was writing these letters as governor on behalf of the Marianas Islands. Is he going to get dragged into this investigation, or is he going to be able to weasel out of it?
Well, right now, we actually just saw something that said, you know, the White House is actually going to give back a $6,000 campaign contribution that came from Abramoff. So they are trying to sort of, you know, preempt, if you will, any tie to Abramoff other than, you know, the $6,000. You know, we haven't heard a lot about the president being involved yet. It's more about Tom DeLay and Bob Ney and, you know,
yeah.
Senator Dorgan. But, you know, Tom, these days the president is involved in so many things. He could get pulled in, and it could be another thing to pull him down.
Yeah, amazing. Well, we'll see. We'll see. Time will tell. Greg Gorman with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Greg, thanks so much for being with us today.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
Great speaking with you. It's the Tom Hartman radio program where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination, or at least clean elections.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. It's Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius satellite radio, on beaming around the planet on radiopower.org, whiterosesociety.org, airamericaradio.com, and CRN Digital on digital TV systems in 29 states, in fact, in addition to the radio stations and all that other stuff. Welcome back to our program. Dan Kane is with us. He's with the United Mine Workers of America, umwa.org, their website. Hey, Dan, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tops. Good to be here.
Dan, a terrible tragedy in West Virginia. It seems to me, and I'm not on the inside with regard to mining, certainly, but it seems to me that this is a tragedy which is the tail end of a whole series of tragedies that go back to the 80s, many of which could have been prevented if we had not had your union, among others, being systematically busted apart or under attack anyway by conservative administrations, starting with Reagan's attack on organized labor, and now the Bush administration's attack on mine safety standards. Am I off base on this?
No, you're not off base at all. You're right. It certainly is a tragedy. In fact, you would think it would be impossible to heap one tragedy on top of the other, but unfortunately, that's what happened. And our we don't represent the miners at this mine, but they are fellow miners, and we have offered our help immediately. In you know, the minute that the situation became apparent, but as I said, they found a way to heap one tragedy on top of another, and that is the miscommunication last night, where for several hours family members were led to believe that their loved ones were alive, only to find out that that wasn't true. That misinformation should have been corrected immediately, but it wasn't. But let's get to the larger issue of what's happening in workplace safety throughout this country. You know, we're just astounded sometimes that under this current administration, the MSHA, the Mine Safety and Health Administration, has placed more emphasis on compliance assistance rather than enforcement. They don't enforce the current laws, and because of this, mining conditions, dangerous conditions, can be overlooked. We like to remind the public that all mining laws are written in blood. Every safety regulation that exists is because someone in the past was injured or killed. And the regulatory agencies need to have the ability to strongly enforce the mining laws. They've gotten away from that, and unfortunately, there are many individual inspectors who try really hard to do their jobs, but because of directions from above, the agency gets sent in a different direction, and there's more compliance assistance.
So on the one hand, we have the Bush administration basically not pushing mine safety. I mean, simply bottom line, working to benefit the mine companies. On the other hand, it seems, or not on the other hand, another dimension of this, let's say.
Yes.
Last night, I looked up ICG, the International Coal Group, who owns the Sago mine.
Mm-hmm.
I looked up their 2005 filings with the Securities and Exchange Commission.
Mm-hmm.
And they had just recently acquired another property. They bought the Sago mine last year, in fact.
Definitely.
And in this filing, it's called the S-A1 filing, it says, and I quote, "Assets are high-quality reserves strategically located in Appalachia and the Illinois Basin, are union-free, have limited reclamation liabilities and are substantially free of other legacy liabilities. In other words, legacy liability, we don't owe anybody pensions, and it's union free. They are bragging about the fact that when they acquire these mines, the unions have already been busted up. How is it that the United Mine Workers are not representing every single miner in that area?
Well, that's a good question. It certainly leaves for the potential for great abuse. But let's be clear about why some of these properties are union-free. What the courts in this country, led by the conservative movement, have done, they've used the bankruptcy laws to strip workers of their pension, of their health care, and their employment rights by just going through bankruptcy court, and a judge can, with the stroke of a pen, wipe out all your rights.
So they take the union contracts and just say, that's it, it's no longer a union shop.
That's right. And the workers are just tossed away.
Now,
that's what's happening far too often in this country.
Yeah. Now, I'm noticing all across the United States, we're talking with Dan Kane. He's the Secretary Treasurer with the United Mine Workers of America, umwa.org, the website. And, Dan, it seems that, you know, the assault on organized labor here in the United States in many ways began in 1981 when Reagan busted up PATCO and turned the Labor Department into a hostile force against labor. And it's, by and large, you know, with a little slowing down during the Clinton administration, but by and large it has just, you know, full tilt boogie kept on going. And the other thing that seems to be making it possible for unions to be busted up, for unions to be under assault all across the United States, is the fact that there is, you know, it's a supply and demand thing. As the supply of labor goes up, the price of labor goes down. And we have in the United States right now about 10 million illegal immigrants who are working. And George Bush trying to embrace the Bracero program, trying to bring back basically a slave labor program where, if the employer doesn't say, okay, fine, I'll keep you employed, then these people lose their ability to stay in the United States. I mean, it's a very terrifying thing. And it seems that, in a very cynical way, conservatives are using the existence of illegal immigrants in the United States to drive down the cost of labor and to make it harder for unions to organize. Are you finding, first of all, in the mines, are you finding the presence of illegal immigrant labor to be a factor, or is that simply part of the American zeitgeist, part of the American experience here that's in general making it, adding to the challenges that labor faces?
Well, that's a factor that we're not experiencing to any great degree in the mining industry right now, but I think that's symptomatic of this movement over the last number of years to outsource so many American jobs, looking for the lowest common denominator, trying to drive down the price of labor. Mm-hmm. And what they want is the people in this country to fight over what's left.
Yeah.
While they look for the lowest labor costs anywhere in the world.
Right, whether they have to go outside the country to get it or whether they simply say, hey guys, come on in, we got a job for you.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think it's a mistake to criticize immigrant laborers who are looking for a job.
Oh, I'm not criticizing them.
No, I know you're not.
But, I'm criticizing the employers.
Exactly. That's exactly my point. Well, the people who are trying to make this an argument need to remember that it's the employers who are causing this situation.
Yeah, in my opinion, and I don't want to digress too much and talk about illegal immigration, I was just curious if it was a factor with the mines specifically, but I think that if we passed a law that said any CEO of any company that is found to be hiring illegals goes to jail for 1 year and, no strikes and you're out. Sorry, that's it. You would have 10 million people lined up at the Mexican border trying to get back into Mexico and countries south of there, and the unemployment rate in the United States would go to zero, and the cost of labor would start going up, and the power of labor would return.
I agree.
But we digress.
Yeah.
What are the specific things that the Bush administration has done over the last 5 years that have made this kind of disaster that we saw here in the Sago mine over this last weekend more probable or possible? And also, if you don't mind my gently taking a shot at you guys, how come this isn't on your homepage?
Well, that's a good question. We have been scrambling the last couple days to try and offer whatever aid and assistance that we can to the families of the Sago miners. But let me back up to what you had asked earlier about.
Yeah, because I got to say, as a talk show host here, I have been looking on the web for information about, you know, how the Bush administration has been attacking miners, and it's awful hard to find.
Yeah, it is.
And I know they're doing it.
Oh, absolutely. One of the problems that labor faces is that we're under attack from so many different avenues. And let me tell you what they've done. Under this administration, in addition to placing more emphasis on kind of persuasion rather than enforcement, they make appointments to workers, you know, to like to MSHA, to the Labor Department, that just it puts people hostile to labor.
MSHA being the mining safety.
Exactly. In charge of mine safety. The National Labor Relations Board has been turned into a joke when you try and organize anymore.
So is MSHA now being populated by people from the mining industry as opposed to miners?
I mean, absolutely. The people who are put in charge of MSHA usually represent viewpoints and concerns of the operator, and that makes it tougher for the individual inspectors.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are just shaking their heads going, you know, okay, we hear the news reports, 200 violations in the last year, and then they have this disaster, and how come nobody's being held to account for this? How come Bush isn't talking about this in outraged terms?
Well, let me tell you what those 200 citations mean in addition.
We have about a half a minute, Dan, I'm sorry.
Okay. Citations, those violations, they are backed up by fines. And it needs to be understood that the purpose of those fines are supposed to be to ensure compliance.
Mm-hmm.
Very often they are so low that you and I would get a speeding ticket that would be higher than these citations.
In other words, these companies figure these are just the cost of doing business.
Absolutely.
They can ignore the law. They just pay the fee. Here's $100, guys, go away.
That's
that
right.
Kind of thing.
That's
amazing.
Right.
Dan Kane, the United Mine Workers of America, you guys are doing great work. I wish you the very best in organizing more and more of these miners because they really need you. UMWA.org, the website.
Okay.
Thanks for being with us, Dan. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
You may be an ambassador to England or France. You may like to gamble. You might like to dance. You may be the heavyweight champion of the world. You may be a socialite with a long string of pearls.
But you gotta serve somebody, my friend. Welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour. And we know who's been serving Jack Abramoff. It's been George W. Bush and Tom DeLay and apparently quite a few others, even a few Democrats in there, although that will be the big spin in the media. Oh, there's a few Democrats in there, but by and large it's Republicans. And then, of course, there's the response, well, what do you expect? The Republicans are in office. Well, Jack Abramoff ran his college Republican group back when he was young. I mean, this is over the top. This goes beyond anything any Democrats ever did, ever. And the whole culture of corruption thing here is mind-boggling. Defrauding Indian tribes in Louisiana, Michigan, Mississippi, New Mexico, and Texas of millions of dollars, $20 million. Abramoff skims off the top of this thing, starts passing it out to by and large Republicans, $100,000 to Bush's 2004 reelection effort, getting him a title pioneer from the campaign. Is the Bush administration going to give back the $100,000? That Abramoff raised for Bush then? Are they going to give back the money that Abramoff gave Bush back in 1997 when he was governor of Texas and he was writing letters supporting the Marianas Islands and their school choice program? I mean, come on. In Bush's first 10 months in office, Abramoff and his lobbying team logged at least 200 contacts with the administration on behalf of just one client. Guess who? Those same guys that George W. was writing about back in 97 when he was governor of Texas, the Northern Mariana Islands. These contacts included John Ashcroft, and people in Dick Cheney's office. Scotty McClellan, if laws were broken, he must be held to account for what he did. Yeah. Well, let's ask George about that. Let's ask George about that. And what about the Sun Cruise fleet? These gambling ships, $147.5 million conspiracy for wire fraud and mail fraud in connection with the purchase of the Sun Cruise fleet, and that Abramoff bought. And two weird little things about it. One, the guy who sold it to them just suddenly gets murdered as he's driving down the street in a gangland-style killing. And number two, there seem to be some reports that Mohammed Atta and a few of the other Florida hijackers, the guys who were down in Florida learning how to fly airplanes before they crashed them into the Twin Towers, that Mohammed Atta and a couple of his buddies were on the Sun Cruise ships. Now, that's probably just a coincidence. They went to Vegas to gamble, too. Apparently, these guys weren't quite the good Muslims they were made out to be. But why isn't anybody questioning this? Why aren't people looking into this? I don't get it. It's just, it's mind-boggling. There is an entire industry of corruption. The Arizona Republic, for example, reports that Congress is almost completely bought off by big business. David Sirota notes this. Local and state governments can no longer rely on their congressional delegations to advocate seriously for municipal priorities. They have to hire professional lobbyists. Local and state governments have to buy professional lobbyists to compete with the professional lobbyists of big business. I mean, this is nuts. In Montana, members of Congress have actually gotten municipalities to use taxpayer cash to pay for Abramoff-connected lobbyists. It's mind-boggling. Just absolutely mind-boggling. And then you look at, it's bigger than even Abramoff. I mean, you look at the big total here. This is just, let's just look at pharmaceuticals. Okay, totally step away from Abramoff and just look, talk about a money-drenched political system. Just look at pharmaceuticals. In the year 2006, $5,187,393 in contributions to political candidates, the 2006 cycle. Of that, $1.5 million went to Democrats, $3.6 million went to Republicans, 70% to Republicans. In 2004, $18 million. I started out with 2006. This is, you know, so far, right? 2000 for the election cycle. So we're really, it has not yet begun. Go back to 2004, $18 million. Of that, $12 million goes to Republicans, $6 million to Democrats. 2002, $21 million to Republicans, $7 million to Democrats. 2000, $18 million to Republicans, $8 million to Democrats. Now, you'll add all this stuff up, and we've got from 1990 to 2006, $83 million in donations to Republicans, $41 million in donations to Democrats. That's a total of $125 million, which is nothing compared to the billions that the pharmaceutical industry is making just on, for example, the Medicare law that says that the government can't negotiate with pharmaceutical companies for lower prices. They are literally making billions. They invest $125 million, and they make billions. Can you? I mean, there's no place else in America where you can make that kind of an investment and make that kind of return. And so, you know, smart guys like Jack Abramoff come along and say, hey, you know, we can buy politicians, a few thousand dollars here, a few thousand dollars there, half a million here, a quarter million there, and, you know, we get votes from them that allow us to make hundreds of millions, billions, tens of billions. I got to say, you know, not only do we have a culture of corruption in Washington, D.C., but we got the cheapest hookers on earth. I mean, these guys give prostitutes a bad name. They don't know how to price their services. If we're gonna truly have corruption in the government, at least they should price it properly. Hey, you're gonna make $1 billion profit on this. We're gonna charge you $900 million, not $5,000. Now, I'm speaking facetiously, of course. We have a broken system, and we need to fix it. It's just that simple. I'm Tom Hartman. Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. News without conflicts of global corporate interests. Tom Hartman here with you, and now...
Now, behind enemy lines.
Yes, indeed. The cons spin without having to listen to the cons. A Rasmussen poll was done recently. Rasmussen is, generally considered a fairly decent polling organization. And they asked this question of Americans. Quote, do you believe the National Security Agency should be allowed to intercept telephone conversations between terrorism suspects in other countries and people living in the United States? End of quote. Now, notice, in that sentence, nowhere does it say, without warrants. See, we have this thing in the United States. It's called a balance of power between the executive, the judicial, and the legislative branches of government that basically rejects the idea of our having a king. We said originally, the idea of a democracy in a constitutionally limited republic, great idea. The idea of a king, bad idea. In fact, originally, when the framers were putting together the Constitution, there wasn't even an executive branch in it. There was not even a president. And conservatives like Hamilton and progressives like Madison both felt, we really need to have a chief executive, a surrogate king of some sort. And the reason why was because we had to have some sort of head of state. Now, see, in the United Kingdom, for example, the head of state is the queen. So she cuts ribbons and she does, in a constitutionally limited monarchy, in a constitutional monarchy, the head of state is the queen or the king. But the head of government is the prime minister. He's the one who makes the laws. She's the head of state. So there has to be a face. And so the framers and the founders said, we need to have a head of state. Now, who's the head of government in the United States? We the people. Read the Constitution. So anyhow, the Constitution, they set this thing out and they say, we've got to be very careful that the army never gets too much power. We'll put the army under the control of an elected civilian. Make that the president. But he can't, and we'll put the police powers of the state, the Department of Justice, the FBI, all that kind of stuff, we'll put that under the power of the president, the executive branch of power. But we have to be careful that the president never takes on the powers of a king. And so if any of the police agencies of the United States representing the executive branch of power, because the judicial branch, Congress, they don't have a police force, they don't have an investigative arm, and the Supreme Court, the court system, doesn't have a police force and an investigative arm for all practical purposes. So it's the executive branch. So if the executive branch says, we're going to arrest you, or, we're going to search your home, or we're going to listen into your telephone, they have to at least prove to one of the other branches of government, specifically the judicial branch, that there's some small fragment of reason why they're doing it. They don't have to convict you before they do it. They don't even have to prove that you probably did something. All I have to prove is that you might be doing something in order to get a warrant to search your home. The Fourth Amendment's actually rather specific about it. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. Now, the thing that they were all flipped out about back then, Declaration of Independence, one of the things that we were upset about was general warrants. The king could issue a warrant simply on his own say-so and have your house searched. And that's why the Fourth Amendment goes on to say, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the things or persons to be seized. In other words, get a warrant. So then we have this problem. Okay, in the age of terrorism, actually it was, you know, a decade and a half ago, in the age of electronic and multinational enemies, the Cold War, whatnot, how do you deal with this? You've got to be able to, you know, sometimes you find out about something and 30 seconds later, you've got to be on them. So they created the FISA court and they said, you have up to 3 days to come back to us after you've already done the search and say, you know, we'd like to know what's going on. So anyhow, here's this Rasmussen poll that says the national security, you know, asks Americans, do you agree or disagree with this statement? The National Security Agency should be allowed to intercept telephone conversations between terrorism suspects in other countries and people living in the United States. Do you agree with that or you disagree with that? Well, I agree with it. I would think most Americans would agree with it. Sure, they should be allowed to intercept telephone conversations, with one caveat. Subject to a warrant. I don't want them listening to me unless they have some evidence that I'm doing something wrong. Then I have no problem with them listening to me or you or anybody else. But the Rasmussen poll did not insert that. They implied that the whole debate here is not whether or not Bush was wiretapping people without warrants, but whether or not the NSA should simply be listening in on phone conversations between terrorism suspects in other countries and people living in the United States. And oddly, 64% of Americans said, you know, agreed with the statement. I thought 100% should. But in any case, 64%. Now, but it doesn't mention that Bush authorized this surveillance without any oversight from any court or from Congress. And then the conservatives take this out and completely turn reality upside down on its head in the media. Pat Buchanan, MSNBC political analyst Pat Buchanan, Washington Post columnist Charles Krautheimer, CNBC host Lawrence Kudlow, conservative radio talk show host Michael Reagan, the adopted son of Ronald Reagan, they all talked about this poll as if it was defending George W. Bush's warrantless wiretaps. I mean, it is incredible. In Time Magazine, January 9th edition, Krautheimer writes, Democrats dare not suggest that the program be abolished because according to a Rasmussen poll, 64% of Americans, a free and very sensible people, support eavesdropping on calls between suspected terrorists abroad and people in the U.S. Krautheimer, just turning reality upside down. Michael Reagan in frontpagemag.com. He says, another poll in December 28, 2005 showed that a whopping 64% of Americans believe the National Security Agency should be allowed to intercept telephone conversations between terrorism suspects in other countries and people living in the United States. Well, yeah. But that doesn't say that any percentage of Americans believe that the president should be able to order it without a warrant. On MSNBC's Hardball with Chris Matthews, January 2nd, Pat Buchanan. He says Bush's surveillance program, backed by the Constitution of the American people, Buchanan. He's not only right, Chris, the president of the United States, something like 64% of the American people agree with him. 81% are Republicans. Matthews, on what point? Buchanan, on the specific point that the president of the United States has the inherent authority to eavesdrop telephone calls overseas in a war on terror. 51% of Democrats agreed with that, the Rasmussen poll. The country is with him. This, excuse me, is a very much a journalistic story. End quote. Buchanan, just twisting it around. A National Review Online, December 30th, Kudlow, who is their economics editor, he writes, and I quote, worse, the Democrats' ACLU-type response to reports of NSA eavesdropping without court warrants is a huge mistake. The latest Rasmussen poll reports that 64% of respondents believe the NSA should be allowed to tap cell phones and emails in order to intercept communications between suspected foreign and domestic terrorists. Are you getting it, how these guys are turning reality inside out? How they're taking 64% of Americans say the NSA should be able to listen in on conversations between terrorists and people domestically. I think 100% of Americans should say the NSA should be able to listen in on conversations between suspected terrorists and people in the United States. But to say that somebody's a suspected terrorist means you have to at least get a warrant saying we suspect they're a terrorist. Do you really want the NSA listening into your telephone conversations with your doctor, with your kids or with your parents, with your best friend, with your significant other? Do you really want all those recorded? Here's the big issue, and this is the question that nobody's asking. Is the reason why Bush is having the NSA spy on people inside the United States without warrants because he's afraid to go to a court and say, I want a warrant to wiretap John Kerry during the 2004 election? Because I think that's what this is all about. Increasingly, it is the only conclusion that I can come to, that Bush has been spying on his political enemies. And they're trying to do it under cover of national security. And now that the story has been broken, they're going after the leaker, the guy who broke the story, rather than saying, oh, gee, maybe somebody committed a crime in the White House. Maybe somebody committed a crime at the NSA. Maybe Bush committed a crime. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Today you're working for the man.
Welcome back.
Well, pick up your feet. We got a deadline to meet. I'm gonna see you make it on time. Now, don't relax. I won't back.
21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The problem with the current laws is enforcement, says Phil Smith, Communications Director for the United Mine Workers of America. In the last hour, we heard from the UMWA. According to an AFL-CIO analysis, here's where the rubber meets the road, my friends. The Bush administration cut 170 positions from Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration, Mine Safety and Health Administration, and has not proposed a single new mine safety or standard or rule during its tenure. Now, Clinton signed the International Labor Organization's Convention 176 concerning safety and health in mine, and mining deaths dropped from 425 in 1970 to 85 in 2000. Bush administration, instead of reducing the risk in mines, they cut 170 jobs out of the Mine Safety and Health Administration. And now, why would they do that? Well, according to the Washington Post, West Virginia coal firms raised $275,000 for George W. Bush. And as noted earlier in the program, it doesn't take a lot of money in Washington, D.C. to change things around. In fact, last September, George Bush rewarded the coal industry for that $275,000. He put Richard Stickler in charge of the Mine Safety and Health Administration. Who, you ask, is Richard Stickler? Well, Richard Stickler is a guy who spent 30 years as a manager of Beth Energy, a coal company. And mines that were managed by Stickler, this is not a union guy, this is management. Mines that were managed by Stickler were marked by worker injury rates more than double the national average, according to government data cited by the United Mine Workers Union. There you have it. Right on its face. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. If you want to drop by our chat room, tomhartman.com. We'll get you there, however you spell it. Welcome, Deanna, to the program from Sacramento, California. Hey, how you doing?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Sure. I just wanted to mention, you know, it's obvious how one law applies to them and one law applies to us, but you know as well as I know is if you have taken that money illegally, and it was somehow being able to be traced back to you and I, and you gave me some, and then suddenly we tried to give it back, I would still be held accountable, and you would still be held accountable.
Yeah, perhaps a better analogy, Deanna, is if the guy next door to you, comes over one day and says, hey, how'd you like to buy a $500 stereo for $50?
Exactly.
And, you know, it's a pretty good guess that he stole it, right? Particularly
right.
If he's kind of a shady character. If you buy that from him for that $50, and then the police come along and say, we believe you're in possession of stolen goods and that's a crime, you say, oh, hang on just a minute, and you run over and you give it back to him and say, here's your stereo back, give me back my $50. I don't think it's going to wash with them.
No, it wouldn't. It'd be like the ink explosion on when somebody steals the money from the bank. Just
right.
Doesn't mean just because you want to give it back now that it's not any good.
Right, there you go.
You
please take this
away from it.
Right, please take this money back. I want to be like Senator Gordon Smith. I'm going to give the money back, or
exactly.
The Bush White House, or
yeah.
You know, Byron Dorgan, apparently, for that matter.
Well, you know, it's been obviously a common thread from the beginning. It's just that, you know, they can say that they misspoke or this or that, and they can just go ahead and just backpedal, and it's given to them. And
yeah.
And I think that we have met their match now, because Abramoff has obviously shown that he was slimy in the beginning, he's going to be slimy now, and he's going to take them all down with him.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And,
you can't trust guys like that.
Yeah, and that might ultimately be the very best thing for democracy. Deanna, thanks so much, and thanks for listening there in KSAC Talk City in Sacramento, California. Ed in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening in WPTT. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Yes, good afternoon. You know, you were talking about the president gathering information on different people without a warrant.
Right.
That actually undermines our security, because even if somebody were charged based on this evidence, the evidence would be tainted because there was no warrant to gather the evidence, and the person would, in effect, be set free.
Right. It's called the exclusionary rule, and it's the result of several Supreme Court rulings, including the Miranda ruling. And that's what causes me to think that Bush is not doing this against terror suspects, because, or against people that he intends to prosecute. Because if he was doing warrantless searches against terror prospects, as you say, Ed, he would be eliminating the possibility of he himself actually being able to prosecute these people. That's why I think that he's doing warrantless wiretaps against people he has no intention of prosecuting. That would be his political adversaries. I think he's wiretapping Democrats.
And I think you're right.
I think he's been doing it for 3 years.
I think you're right. That's why I mentioned that, because I was trying to figure out myself. I said, now, there's no way this evidence will ever stand up. So what the heck's going on? So
right.
it could be his political.
And I think that's also why some people in the NSA refused to go along with it. One judge on the FISA judge actually resigned, a very nice cushy job over this thing. Why people in the Justice Department refused to go along with it. They had to go to John Ashcroft, who's, you know, on his, in, doped up on morphine after gallbladder surgery, in order to get him to sign off on it. I think, you know, that's why you've got so many people inside this administration going, oh, this is too much like Watergate for me. And because that's what Watergate was all about. It was misusing the FBI and the CIA. I mean, that was Article 2 of the impeachments, of the Articles of Impeachment against Richard Nixon, were for misusing the FBI and the CIA for domestic intelligence against political opponents, not against criminals. Ed, thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Now you love me as a loser, but now you're worried that I just might win. You know the way to stop me, but you don't have the discipline.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes before the hour. Oh, the good old Leonard Cohen there. One of my absolute favorites. In fact, for a while we overplayed it. Democracy is coming to the USA. It's just, in fact, it may be even coming up. Who knows? Welcome back to the program. Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting. 34 minutes past the hour. Coming up on 25 minutes before the top of the hour. That would be before, before noon on the Pacific and before 3 o'clock on the East Coast. So, you know, and you can do your calculations from wherever that may be. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening on WPTT. Hey, Gary, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks again for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a little different take on all of this, if you will. Yes, this imperial presidency, I saw it during Nixon. You saw it, right?
Sure.
And, boy, we have strong indications. This is out of hand. This is...
You've got Cheney coming out saying, we're just taking back the powers that Nixon lost. And I'm like, wait a minute, you mean you're taking back the powers that Nixon grabbed and lost?
Well, yes, exactly. And we need to take it to these people, if you will. Here's my take on this. And this really, I want to see what you think, and maybe somebody else may call, I don't know. But What's your thought about this? I believe, and I'm sad to say, it saddens that I feel this way, that I feel a lot more people than we think, middle ground people, good people, just a little left, you know, I hate to use the word left and right, but you know what I mean, a little left and little right, is that,
yeah.
have basically, in a way, given up, Tom, in that they work so hard all these years, they see what's going on, they feel they're not capable of changing anything, which they can if they pull the right lever, and they've just I'm going to protect what I have. I work so hard for it, and I just can't go to the next step.
Yeah,
you seem. I hope I'm being clear. Sometimes I'm.
Well, yeah, I think you were, Gary. I got distracted there just for a second. But is there a question in there?
Yeah. Do you believe like I do? Wealth, clearly, and not that I'm talking the religious aspect of it,
right.
Wealth is undermining our democracy. Period.
Oh, sure, yeah. And one of the best documentaries of that is written by the Republican, Kevin Phillips, the guy who wrote the Emerging Republican Majority, who basically laid the groundwork, you know, who was one of Nixon's speechwriters and Republican strategist. Kevin Phillips wrote this book called Wealth and Democracy in America, and it's absolutely brilliant, and I recommend everybody read it. In fact, I was going to make it my Buzz Flash Book of the Month this month, and Mark Carlin said he'd already done the book, so I couldn't.
One more question, if I may.
Yeah, absolutely.
How do we get the middle America to step up to the plate, and with citizens comes some responsibility?
We do it the way that Bernie Sanders does it, and that's by talking about bread and butter issues, by talking about the economy, by saying, you know, are you better off? Do your kids have a good chance to go to college? Is there an opportunity in your family for economic and social mobility?
But it doesn't seem to be working like it should.
Oh, it is working. I mean, it absolutely is working. Yes,
okay.
All across the United States, you have truly progressive candidates like Bernie, like the governor of Montana. I'm forgetting his name. Right now, but here's a progressive.
And I like Ken Conrad also.
Yeah, who was elected the governor of a red state, and the guy is extremely progressive. It is the lukewarm Democrats. It's the DLC Democrats. It's the Ron Emanuel Democrats. It's the Hillary Clinton Democrats that scare me the most, frankly, Gary, because they're the ones who I think are going to say, you know, yeah, well, let's go down the middle road, which means that they're basically Republican light. And I agree with Harry Truman, who the Democrat. Democratic President of the United States, Harry Truman, who said the American people, given a choice between voting for a Republican or voting for a Democrat who behaves like a Republican, will always vote for the Republican. And he's right. And we need Democrats who behave like Democrats. George in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, George, thanks for listening to us on Talk 1090 there.
Yeah, I was just going to mention, you know, I think the president's just taken a page out of J. Edgar Hoover's book. He doesn't necessarily want to take anybody to court, but if he has a lot of information on him,
yeah, blackmail
them, very quiet.
Scare them.
Do you get that?
Yeah, I said blackmail them, scare them. That's what J. Edgar Hoover did to his political opponents. It's what he did to a series of presidents.
Right, and I was wondering, did they ever come up with his files that he had hidden away, or did his secretary destroy them all?
Who knows?
Okay, and then the other question.
I tell you, the book on that, by the way, if you're curious about the history of J. Edgar Hoover.
Well, I read the book about him. How he
Anthony Summers. Private and confidential.
Kind of stand up in his office and watch each president being inaugurated like he's a little prince.
Yeah.
But did Thomas Jefferson say that a civil war every now and then isn't a bad thing? Or something to that effect?
He said, from time to time, the tree of liberty must be watered by the blood of patriots.
Okay.
And when he said that, it was in the early days of the French Revolution.
Oh, okay.
And he thought that the French Revolution was going to turn out like the American Revolution. And later, when the French Revolution, when Maximilian Robespierre took over, and, you know, when Tom Paine went over there and tried to talk some sense into them, and they threw him into prison, and they got the guillotine out, and they were chopping off 15, 20, 30 people's heads a day, and it was just running continuously. At that point, then, Jefferson wrote to, as I recall, it was Ben Rush, who was one of his close friends, and said, you know, essentially, I wish I'd never said that.
Okay, then the other quote was, if you're willing to trade your basic constitutional rights for security, you'll have neither. Is that?
That's Ben Franklin said. Those people who think that, and this one I don't have memorized as well as Jefferson's, but it's to the effect of those people who think that you can have a nation with security and freedom with absolute security and absolute freedom are wishing for something that never has existed and never will.
Yeah, they never will have either. You can't have both.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks, George. Dick in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Dick, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, Tom, you mentioned Watergate as the basis for removing Nixon coming from the left, and appropriately so. But I think we can get confused.
Actually, Dick, if you go back and look, you will see that 7 out of the 12, as I recall, I'm doing this from memory, but a majority of the Republicans on the House Select Committee, I believe the Judiciary Committee, whichever committee it is in the House that votes on whether or not to put an article of impeachment before the floor of the House, the majority of the Republicans, now all of the Democrats, of course, voted for it, but a majority of the Republicans also voted for it. This was not just a partisan thing taking down Nixon. The Republicans were as horrified as the Democrats were.
But we don't want to forget the fact that Watergate came from the far right, namely James McCord, who came from Internal Security at the CIA, who ran the burglars, and he made his reasons for getting rid of Nixon, most notably his letter to Judge John Sirica, as well as the sabotaging the burglary. He made them very clear, as did Robert Vesco later in testimony from his hideouts down there in Latin America. And basically, they said essentially that Nixon was destroying the country and the CIA, and I believe it had mostly to do with his secret peace talks with Vietnam, with Kissinger, and they were horrified of being cut out of the loop. So it was really Mark Felt, of course, was a protege of J. Edgar Hoover. So most of this, the initiative at least, came from the far right, and they eventually got what they wanted.
Yeah, interesting commentary, Dick. I wasn't familiar with all of that detail, but what I can tell you is that, you know, Americans by and large were horrified, and the quote far right, the people on the right, say the Ron Pauls, for example, Congressman Ron Paul of Texas, who's probably the most conservative member of the House of Representatives, who's been a guest on this program, who is horrified by an administration that would wiretap without a warrant. I mean, you know, there are people on the right, as well as on the left, who still believe in the Constitution of the United States. And there were people on the right as well as the left who were horrified by Nixon, and you're finding them now speaking out. You know, Arlen Specter coming out and saying, you know, we need to investigate what George W. Bush is doing. It's Republicans who have the power to institute an investigation into this, and they're actually doing it. Or at least it looks like they're doing it. So we'll see. We'll see how all that plays out. I'd like to change the topic for a moment and just share with you. We've been talking on and off about economics on this program forever. I mean, you know, it's an eternal topic. But over the course of the last couple of days, the economic situation in the United States and what the future holds for us, as we have a new Fed chairman coming in, Ben Bernanke is going to be taking the place of Alan Greenspan. And a lot of people concerned about that. What direction is the American economy going? Where are we at? Walmart stores, for example, expected December same store sales to be between 2 and 4%. Turned out they were around 2.2% for the holidays. Not good. And this is basically the bottom end of the economic ladder in the United States, not spending money, which means, you know, this is the engine that's been holding America alive. Well, what I'd like to share with you is a comparison between what it would be like to work at McDonald's. We'll just take McDonald's, for example. I mean, I was talking about Walmart, McDonald's, another one. To work at a McDonald's in the United States, or to work at a McDonald's in, say, Brittany, France. In Texas in the U.S., or in Brittany in France. And what would the difference be? Is it possible that government policy, by defining the rules of the game of business, can make sure that everybody can actually make a living, can reduce poverty, and still encourage business? That even a company like McDonald's can do well all around the world, and in many countries do well and support a middle class. I have to share the details of Republican capitalism versus French capitalism with you in just a moment. We'll do it right after this break. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, the True People's Radio, the free speech, a real free speech zone here. No barbed wire, no RNC passes. 45 minutes past the hour.
the Tom Hartman Program.
It's coming through a hole in the air from those gnats in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the field, but this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly real.
It's coming, my friends.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
Or at least it will if you and I get politically active between now and November of 1996. And why it takes a Canadian like Leonard Cohen to tell us that, I don't know. But anyhow, by the way, NBC News, Andrea Mitchell, talking to James Risen here. Andrea Mitchell asking, asking James Risen, do you have any information that Christian Amanpour might have been eavesdropped upon? Here's Andrea Mitchell, the wife of Alan Greenspan, and one of the senior NBC correspondents, you know, in the world, out loud asking, is George Bush bugging Christian Amanpour? What's going on here? See, this is what I'm telling you. I'm telling you, he is the reason Bush wants to bug people without warrants. It's not because he intends to prosecute them, but it's because he wants to know what's going on with people that he considers to be potential political enemies, whether it's John Kerry or Christian Amanpour. But back to McDonald's versus McDonald's. In Texas, USA, McDonald's pays a minimum wage of $5.15. In Brittany, France, McDonald's pays a minimum wage in U.S.-adjusted dollars of $9.16 an hour. In Texas, USA, a family of four, both parents working at McDonald's, they have to work 40 hours a week. In Brittany, France, family of four, both parents working at McDonald's, maximum 35 hours a week. In Texas, USA, working at McDonald's, you get time off for having a child 6 weeks without pay. In France, time off for having a child, 1 year with pay of $1,000 a month or 3 years at $700 a month. Income, this is for a family of two working at McDonald's full-time. In the U.S., the income would be $412 a week or $1,771 a month. It's for both people working at McDonald's. In France, it would be $641 a week or $2,757 a month plus $350 a month because they have two children. In San Antonio, the rent in Texas, USA, two-bedroom apartment, say $600. In Brittany, France, two-bedroom government house, housing for the working poor is worth $200 a month near Vaughan. Child care in Texas, probably can't afford it. Child care in France, this is for the people working for McDonald's, the family where both mother and father working for McDonald's, free, paid for by the government. Health insurance for the two people working at McDonald's in the United States, probably none. It's too expensive. France, free universal health care. The couple working in McDonald's in Texas, USA, vacation time? None. In Brittany, France, 5 weeks paid vacation after the first year. Paid vacation. School in the United States for their kids, free from kindergarten to high school. In France, the couple who works at McDonald's, school free from preschool through university, all the way up to a PhD, totally free. If they become unemployed in the U.S., $911 a month for 26 weeks. In France, $2,000 a month until they get another job. Retirement, in the United States, they start receiving Social Security at the age of 67. In France, they retire at the age of 60 and receive Social Security. We're living, as Holly Sklar says, the American dream in reverse. brilliant piece she wrote. Happy New Year, American Dream. The hourly wages of average workers are 11% lower than they were back in 1973 when you adjust them for inflation. On the other hand, CEO salaries up 30%. Just last year, median household income has fallen an unprecedented 5 years in a row. Every single year of the Bush administration, median household income fallen. If people hadn't worked, if it wasn't that people were working more hours, it would have fallen even lower. But we're working now an average of 200 hours a year more than workers in any other industrialized nation. We're breaking records that America simply shouldn't break, as Holly Sklar points out. Record numbers of Americans have no health insurance, more than ever before in our history. The share of national income going to wages and salaries is the lowest since 1929. Middle-class households with a medical crisis, toast. Half of all bankruptcies. Outsourced jobs, busted pensions. The congressional majority voted, Holly Sklar notes, the biggest cut in history to the student loan program at a time when college is more important for social mobility and more expensive than ever before. Public college tuition has risen even faster than private tuition, jumping 54% over the past 10 years, adjusted for inflation. Contrary to myths, she notes, the United States is not becoming more competitive in the global economy by taking the low road. We are growing in hock to other countries. Huge trade deficit, hollowed out manufacturing base, deteriorating research and development, infrastructure built by earlier generations, by the greatest generation, eroded greatly. Everything falling apart, schools falling apart, roads falling apart, and what does Bush do? He borrows another $2 billion every single day from other countries to keep the government running so that he can continue to give so-called tax cuts to millionaires and billionaires. It's time for us to make a change, my friends. We have to get involved. Thanks so much for being with us. Remember, tag, you're it. Get involved.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.